Welcome back. My name's Thomas. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Thomas.
Before we get started, just want to say a big thank you to this morning's speakers and also to Lucy, who did a great job this morning and also made all the lunch. So thank you, Lucy. So this is the afternoon session of the first annual Downtown Reading Old Timers Day. This group wishes no negative atmosphere. Please respect this. Phones on silent, no sweets or gum chewing, no texting, and no electronic cigarettes. The preamble is going to be read by Julie.
I'm Julie, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Julie.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Thanks, Julie. And Richard is going to read How It Works.
My name is Richard, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Richard.
Chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault, they seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Some of these we bought. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. Were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C. That God could, and would if he was sought.
Thanks, Richard. As this morning, just before the moment's silence, I'm going to read through a list of 23 names of old-timers no longer with us. Tom G, Walter, Jesse, Jimmy A, Ron G, MS John, SAS Angry John, Babs, Michael Kevin, Fireman Colin, Tall Mark, Taxi Gary, Wee Adam, Martin the Monk, Lockkeeper Joe, Young Maidenhead Mark, America John, Vera from Newbury, Melvin, Sheila from Bracknell. The next four names, one of which I've just said, are close to four of our speakers today. Vera of Newbury, to Alan from Thatcham, Eve of Henley for Mick Ferret, Barry of Wantage, Anne's husband, and Pat of Twyford, Terry's close friend. These are just a few names of many who we today owe a great debt of gratitude. Now, James is going to come up with Anne, and that will be the next session. Thanks, Richard. Thanks.
James and alcoholic.
Hi, James.
I'd just like to introduce Anne from Wantage, Barry's wife.
Thanks very much, James. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Anne and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Anne.
First correction. Anne is not Wantage. Barry was Wantage. Anne is Oxford Monday. So get that right.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, that's all right, James. That's all right. But lots of people associate me with Wantage. Where does one begin? My heavens, if I was to go back the whole way, we'd be here this time tomorrow. And I'd say you'd have a few pains and aches by then. I'm an alcoholic, and it took me a long time to come round to that. And when eventually I did, I was at an open meeting in Wantage on a Tuesday night. I think I was driving my husband mad. Anyway, I went to the open meeting, and he had some AA people in the car. And he, for some reason, said, I'll drive you home first. I'm sure he was smelling alcohol from me, and he had had enough of me. And he drove me home first, and then he was taking the AA people home. And I decided, for probably one of the rare times that I drank whiskey, that I'd have some whiskey, and to face it. And I didn't know what I was facing. I honestly still baffled why it was on that Tuesday night, drinking whiskey, that I said, when Barry came back, I gave him the Who Me leaflet, and I said, ask me the 20 questions.
What?
Those of you, there's some of you here who knew Barry and remember him, and he could be very, very short when he needed to be. But I better put it right, because he was also a man of great humour and understanding. So he sat down with the 20 questions, and I'm sitting there full of whiskey and full of whatever I'd been drinking earlier in the day. And he asked me the 20 questions, and I wasn't going to answer aloud, was I? And I said, maybe, yeah, no, no, no. I was still trying to make out that alcohol wasn't a problem for me, really. And when he came to the end of the 20 questions, I said, well, am I? Are you what? Am I? What are you saying? I said, am I? He said, that's for you to know and for me to go to bed. And the next morning, he always got up early, and he was going off to work. And he We had the old-fashioned telephones. There was no such thing as mobile phones or anything. There weren't even motorways then. And he threw the phone to me, and he said, if you need help, you know the number to ring. Ring it. And that morning I rang an old-timer of the fellowship and said, I needed help. And that man was a man named Stanley, and his son is sitting down there today, and who drove me over today, and you'll be listening to him later. And Stanley and Anna, his lovely wife, came, and I knew them both very well, and the reason I knew them was because Barry, as you've gathered, was also an alcoholic, and he got sober before me. But he had a lot of, it's not Barry's story I'm telling, but it is very much part of mine. He was hospitalized in various things for somewhere from about 1967 to 1972 when he finally stopped drinking. And Anna and Stanley, Anna particularly at that time, played a great part in my life. And when Barry was hospitalized for the last time, which was the Warnford, which was then called an asylum, he was in there, and Anna would ring me every morning just on 9 o'clock, and all she would say to me was, what are you doing today, and what have you on, etc., etc. And somehow or other, she was the one person that allowed me to think that there was still some hope for me, or for us, because I felt with Barry's alcoholism, a professional man in Oxford, and he was in and out of asylums, and shame and embarrassment and everything else. And Anna seemed, that would lift off me when I talked to Anna. And she would also invite, she on Barry's first Sunday, being allowed out at the Warnford, she invited us to lunch. And I think that was probably one of the few times, with the exception of two other friends who called me to know if I had money to feed the children. I had four young children at that time. And it seemed as if the whole world had gone away. But I suppose it's because I had isolated myself because of the shame and the embarrassment and everything else. And I won't say I was new in England, but I was youngish and reasonably new in England, and always for a long time felt inferior because I was an Irish girl that came to England, and everybody seemed so together and full of themselves and full of confidence, and there was this little shriveling violet. She didn't look it on the outside, because at 5'9" you're not a shriveling anything. And you know, and that's how it was. And then Stanley came into play for me, because on that morning that I've just mentioned, I think Anna answered the phone, and I don't remember the conversation, but what I do know is on that morning, because only my daughter was in the house with me, and she was just coming up to 15, and she's profoundly deaf and had been born without hearing, and my three sons, and I had all four of them in 5 years, so they were I'll tell you, it was a tough old time. But Karen, my daughter, had turned away from me at that time, because in the month of March she had faced me in the kitchen and said, you've been drinking, in her way of communicating. And of course, what does any drinking alcoholic say? Of course I haven't. No, I haven't. And she said, yes, you have, and I'll find it. Now, you would all go through the thing of that terrible, terrible fear of somebody else finding the bottles. I didn't know where I'd hidden it. I had three or four hiding places. And she, because of, I think, her luck, not having hearing, she knew everything. She just knew everything, even though she couldn't speak. And I thought, she will find it. Oh my God, she will find it. And she turned away from me then, until I came into AA on that day that I've just mentioned. And on that morning, she was the only one in the house, because the boys had gone back to boarding school in Dublin. And I was making an effort to make the house respectable. I'm sure Anna and Stanley were going to be inspecting the house, but this was my effort of getting ready. And Karen came to me in the kitchen, and she said, who's coming? And I told her, and she said, who for? And I said, me. And she put her arm across my shoulder and she said, we go for a walk. And we went up and down the garden, but then I had to get rid of her because I needed a drink to face Anna and Stanley. And I poured a gin and tonic, which was always my drink, until it used to make me so depressed that I would think it was the gin is making me depressed, and I'd switch to something else, and then I'd switch to something. The sherry made me liverish. The gin depressed me. The brandy made my heart go too fast, and with all the time was... In those days, wine was only drunk with meals. We didn't drink it in between meals, and therefore... I was told when I came to England I'd have to drink half pints of beer. And I said, well, I'm going back to Ireland if I have to do that, because there's no way I'm drinking beer. So I had to get rid of Karen so that I could have a gin and tonic. And I sent her up to make the beds. And I poured the gin and tonic and I tried to drink it, and immediately I wanted to be sick. And I went into the downstairs loo and I did my usual thing of heaving. And got sicked it up, then had another gin and tonic and did the same. And then I got clever. I got a half pint glass and I half filled it with gin and I put lager in the other half. Now that's highly intelligent, you know, because the gin was to steady my nerves and the lager was to quench my thirst. So, you know, it's kind of smart for someone that was kind of on her knees. And I did go into the loo on my knees. And I put up the toilet seat and I tried to drink from the opposite side of the glass. The reason being that if you had hiccups, that's what you would do to stop the hiccups, you see, with a glass of water. So this will stop me puking. But it didn't. And up to today, that's my last drink. And that was on the 23rd of April, 1974. And Anne and Stanley duly came and I made them some coffee. And I only remember bits of that day. And I remember Anna taking Karen, my daughter, off for a walk. Anna was a wonderful, wonderful woman of Al-Anon. And I had gone to Al-Anon on and off for 5 or 6 years before I came to AA. And one would imagine, well, didn't she recognize she was an alcoholic long ago if she was going to Al-Anon meetings? But I was about drinker, and I think it's a bit tougher to identify or to understand, because I could go for weeks and months sometimes and not have a drink. But when I had it, and I knew from day one when I had a drink, one drink was never going to be it. It had to be a feed of drink, as they would say in Ireland. And Anna took her off, and I obviously chatted to Stanley, or Stanley spoke to me. And of course, I knew him quite well, which helped. And then we met Barry for lunch, and they agreed between them. And the only thing I remember saying at that lunch was, if ye think I'm going to a meeting in Oxford, you're making a big mistake. Because I don't want to be in as Barry's wife. I'm me. And there was only one meeting in Oxford at that time, and that was the Monday night meeting. And there was Wantage, and there was Aylesbury on Friday night, and there was, I'll think of the name of it, Bampton on a Wednesday night, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. And it was decided, not by me, by Anna and Stanley and Barry, right, we will take Anne out of Oxfordshire and we'll take her to High Wycombe to the meeting, and she'll stay with us tonight and possibly tomorrow night. And obviously I made arrangements. I had my help or something to look after the children, because there's no way I would be, in spite of my drunkenness at times, there's no way I would have left the children uncared for. That was only one of the few good points about me. And off I went to High Wycombe. I meant, like when I wasn't going in Oxfordshire, that I wanted to go to the north of Scotland or somewhere so remote. But anyway, I got to High Wycombe. And at that time, the meeting was in what was like a lean-to shed. But I suppose it was better than that, but that's what it appeared like. And the trains passed there, and the whole place shook. And Stanley poured me, or got, I couldn't imagine Stanley pouring the tea for me, but he gave me a cup of tea, and the tea leaves were floating on top. And I said, Stanley, I don't drink tea. And he looked up at me over his half glasses, and he said, drink it and like it, because that's what you'll be having from now on in. And that's how I was 12-stepped into Alcoholics Anonymous. It was never a question of poor Anne or poor anything. You do it. This is what you do, and you do it. And I stayed with them for the next couple of nights, and I think we went to Aylesbury. And I said, I can't go to Aylesbury. People might know me. So what? You're going to Aylesbury. And I went to Aylesbury, and Stanley said, it's perfect for you. I said, yes, but it's 30 miles from where I live, and I do have four youngsters. And he said, no, Aylesbury and the alcoholic sounds very fitting for you. And I was mortified. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. And I went to Aylesbury every Friday night for the next few years. And at that time, there was a lot of mention this morning about the Lee Clinic. Before that, Barry had one of his hospitalizations, his first one actually, had been the Ashurst Clinic, which was there before the Lee Clinic. And the patients used to have to clean the place and wash up. Now, Terry will understand, and so will Sue, that Barry wasn't into cleaning and doing jobs like that. And on the morning when I'd go up to see Barry, I'd know the days he was supposed to have polished the hall, because they had very polished floors and lovely things in the hospitals in those days. And Barry would have gone around with the thing, and there'd be dust. He hadn't moved anything. And the dust, you could see the dust on the shiny, shiny floor. And we actually, I wasn't sober then or in AA, but we watched the Lee Clinic being built. So we go back, we go back with that with our memories. And the thing was, every Friday, I don't think I was given an option. I think it was my job to go to the Lee Clinic or the Ashurst first, and then when the Lee Clinic was built, to pick up the patients and take them to Aylesbury. And you could have anything from 4 to 6 people in the car, because we had no safety belts, so they all sat in one another's laps. But of course, the meetings, going to the meetings and coming back. And I don't know then whether I gave out about going to. I think Barry answered the phone one day. Do you remember Big Ron, the beard? And he rang up and said, Barry answered the phone, tell Anne she has 6 passengers tonight. And all I heard Barry saying was, she's not a taxi service. So I don't know whether it was then or not. But after that, for some reason, I wasn't going to the clinic, or maybe they weren't being allowed out on a Friday night. I used to pick up Irish Paddy and Tom the Foot. And Tom the Foot was Tom the Foot because he was a chiropodist. So he was, rightly so, he was Tom the Foot. Paddy was 5 foot nothing and would look up at me, and he had one eye going north and one eye going south. And one night he looked up at me and he said to me, you know, he said, you could be quite pretty. if only you'd smile. I thought, I have nothing to smile about. I hate this being an AA. I hate Alcoholics Anonymous. I hate everything. And moving and on in my head. So obviously when I picked them up on a Friday night, I start off on all that was wrong in my life. Now I will tell you, I had a lovely home. I had a husband who was working. I had children going to good schools. I had all that. And yet I thought I was the hardest done by. And so they then must have got together. Oh, and I'd have to have tea and apple tart afterwards. That was part of getting better. We'd have a small meeting in Paddy's house. His sister-in-law would make the tart that day. Anna's coming, so we have to make a tart. And I wouldn't want to. I'd want to go home. But anyway, they started singing. Just imagine going to a meeting and you have two. They were nearly old-timers, I suppose. And they sang Irish songs. And then they'd stop and they'd say, we don't know the words of so-and-so, you probably do. And this was to get, and I'm sure I learned afterwards, to stop me moaning. Now, Oxford at that time, we had the intergroup, and I started going to the intergroup. I was told to go to the intergroup very early on. Babs, who was mentioned there, was chairman. And she was the loveliest, loveliest, loveliest lady. She was such a lady, and Jessie always seemed to be by her side. And I loved Jessie to bits, and cigarette would be here, and the glasses, and smoke would be going up. And I used to just sit in the intergroup meetings because I didn't know what was what, really, and listen, and Babs conducted it so beautifully, and she was such a lovely lady. And then we went to Selsey one of those years, and Babs fell. And I can still see it happening. Babs fell and broke her hip. And poor Babs was carted off to some hospital. And at the time, her husband was very aged, and I think he was a semi-invalid. And of course, then the anxiety was, what happens, I think his name was Ted, if I remember rightly. Isn't it funny, there's parts of that so clear now, and you know, as I've just said, that's 40 years ago. And yet I sometimes wonder in my head, am I making this up? Did it happen? Have I got it right? You know, but I don't think so. I don't think so. So it's lovely to have people of your own time to check that out with, really. I was never asked would I do service. I was told what I was to do, and I did it. But what I was very angry at, within myself, I never appeared to be angry. I appeared, I gather, just to be so buttoned up. And I was angry that nobody seemed to be telling me just how to get sober. I thought, would you stop giving me drunk lugs? And just tell me, you know, you get up in the morning, you make the breakfast, you do this, you do that, and then you do that, and then you do that. And that's how my mind was at the time. I need it. And that's how my discipline really started for myself. And eventually the anger, you know, went away with the meetings. But in my early days, I must tell you this bit, in my early days at Aylesbury, there were all these men around the boardroom table. We were very posh. And we were in the boardroom having the meetings, and we were all in a square, and there was Sam, and there was Norman, and there was Alec, and these are the ones I remember so vividly. My God, how they looked after me, just how they looked after me and kept me safe. They always made me feel safe. But one night, I was still not saying my name is Anne, I'm an alcoholic. Anne, would you like to say something? On to the next person. So one Friday night, I wasn't sitting where I would normally sit, I was sitting up here, and it was the lady from Stow-on-the-Wold, do you remember? And she was in the chair, and she said, Anne, I know, I appreciate now you're in AA a while, would you like to say something? And they went on, and there was only one other lady in the room, and they went on to her, and she started to speak, and if she did, I banged the table with my fist and said, you're the greatest crowd of smug buggers I've ever met. And that was because they wouldn't tell me how to get better. And there was, I'm sure I was frowned upon. And the other big memory that comes to me from Aylesbury was, I went to the clinic to pick up the patients, and they weren't allowed out that night. They had misbehaved, or they had done something, and somebody forgot to ring me to tell me not to come. And of course, that didn't do my mood any good, did it? Driving all the way there. And then I had to go down to 81 Cowley Road, which was a supposedly dry house, and pick up anybody wanting to go from there. And there was a little fella who wanted to come. And as he walked out towards the car, I thought, he's not sober. Anyway, I said, you get in the back, because I thought I was picking your dad, Stanley, up. And you get in the back, and as it happened, Stanley didn't come that evening. He wasn't too well. That was the beginning of him not being well. And this young lad in the back of the car, it wasn't alcohol, but he wasn't with me, in, you know, and I was quite frightened. And then I could smell burning. It was only the seat of my car was being burnt. He'd fallen asleep with a lighting cigarette. So when I got into Aylesbury, Alec said to me, you look bothered. I said, I am. I said, so and so. I said, he's burned the seat of the car. And I said, he's not drunk, but he's not sober. He's on something. And he said, just leave it. You're going home on your own. Don't have to worry. Now, they all lived Amersham way, and I lived Oxford way. they drove that lad back to Cowley Road in Oxford. And then they had to go all the way to Amersham. And that to me was how AA was then. The mileage people did to help one another. But then in another way I should explain, the roads weren't that crowded. And mind you, we didn't have motorways. The roads weren't as crowded and there were fewer of us. There was very few. It was an awful shame to be a woman drunk at that time. There were very few women around, hence Stanley remained my sponsor till he got too ill, bless him. And then my beloved husband had a heart attack in his mid-40s, and I thought, I can't be driving to Aylesbury every Friday night and be out of the house from 6 o'clock till nearly midnight. So I started going to Norham Gardens on Monday night. And that's 34 years ago, and it's still my home group. And I know as an older person, I should be not going into Oxford on a Monday night because I live just outside Abingdon, and but it's I'm tied to Monday night, you know, I'm tied to it, and I know that the sensible bit of me says you must start going to a local meeting so that you don't have the worry about the weather and the parking and the everything on a Monday. And even my children, who are now becoming my parents, or have become my parents, are saying, don't think, Ma, you should be driving into Oxford on your own on a Monday night in the dark nights, you know. Yeah, I hear you. And then I just gaily go on. But they're right. But I can't. There's none of the people there that, when I went there, there's none of those people there now. I mean, I love my group, and it's so changed. Norham Gardens was so beautiful, so beautiful. It was a convent. It was two magnificent North Oxford houses turned into a convent. And Sister Mary was in charge of us. And she loved us to bits. She made the tea, or one of the sisters made the tea and the coffee for us every Monday night, and we had lovely biscuits, or if they'd make cakes for us or whatever. We were spoiled to bits, and we loved it. But then nuns, unfortunately, got old and convents shut down, and that's why we had to move. And the room we're in now, and have been for a number of years, is disgusting. Quite disgusting. And another group borrowed the room recently on a Thursday night because their place was being painted. And I took my young son to the meeting, not something I normally do, but was necessary that night for me to take my youngest son to the meeting. Imagine taking a 15-year-old to a meeting anyway, your son. And I did, and we went on the Thursday night to my room. And here was this other group in my room. And they had the shape of the room different. They weren't in rows, they had it in a circle. My God. Anyway, the first speaker said, I wish to goodness our room was finished being decorated. This is the most awful room I've ever been in. There's no window, there's nothing. I sat there and said, word. That's the sign for patience in sign language. You're calming down all your feelings. And say nothing. So then an old-timer, I suppose he is an old-timer now, eventually spoke. And he said, it'll be so nice to be back in our own nice surroundings. This room is really so dreadful. And I wanted to say to him, who got you sober? This room got you sober. But I didn't. But we were coming to the last few minutes and I couldn't resist it. And I said, I'm here to defend this room. This is why I'm here tonight, to defend this room. This room, and this is very true, this room has taught me discipline. It's taught me loyalty. It's taught me to be less judgmental, which I'm still working on. It's taught me not to be critical. It's taught me so much. So please, it's the people that matter. You forget what the room looks like. Thank you very much. And I'm sure they thought, no timer. Anyway, one of the men did come to me afterwards and say, you're absolutely right. I apologise for criticising the room. Your room. So that's AA was so different in many ways. It's the same, but it's different. It's the same, but it's different. You know, we had lots of old characters who slept out at night. We had some wonderful characters in who would. Simon House was at by the rail track in those days in Oxford, and you had a dry end and a wet end, and really it was only a glorified shed. And I at that time was sober enough to have taken up other things. I used help out with the Deaf Children's Society, and very often after we had parties and things, I would have food left over, and I would always take my children and take the food to Simon House, and the wonderful, wonderful old men, and some of them were such gentlemen when they didn't have drink taken, but it was good for me to smell the wet end, which was horrendous. But nevertheless, when they stopped drinking, they were wonderful. There was one old fellow, he wasn't so old at the time really, but Barry had a habit of collecting people and bringing them home, which I didn't really go on quite a lot. When you're four children, you don't really want people who might just be stopped drinking or might not have stopped drinking in amongst your children, but I got a fair bit of it. And this fellow anyway, he had been in the Merchant Navy. So because he used to make Barry's bed for him in the Ashurst, because Barry couldn't make a bed, Barry felt he owed him something. So he brought him home to me to feed him and to find a bed for him. And anyway, he went back out drinking, and I said, Barry, I'm sorry, I'm not having him in the house while he's drinking. It's not fair on the children. So Barry said, fine. So the next thing, Barry came home and he said, so-and-so, he said, the police have stopped him. I said, what was he doing? He said he was up on the top of a pylon, and he said the panda car stopped at the bottom, and the guard, the policeman, shouted up, come down. And so he came down, and the policeman said to him, and what are you doing up there? I'm bird nesting. And you know, we had so many laughs, and we had so many great stories. We had no telephone service. Absolutely no telephone service, and I remember being at Intergroup when it was decided we should have a telephone service, and I thought I was too new in AA to take part, to verbally take part, and I was sitting back, and they all got cross with one another, and there was terrible arguments going on, where it should be and how it should be and all the rest of it. And I'm there gazing out the window. We were in Norham Gardens, and I'm gazing out in this beautiful tree, and I'm thinking, God grant them the serenity. And the chairman, he was called Don, banged the table, and he said, have you nothing to add to this? And I thought, I'm saying my prayers for all of you. Anyway, we reconvened 3 weeks later, and we were all like different people, and we got eventually, I think it was 1980, we got the telephone service going. Now, you Reading people, be very grateful to South Midlands Intergroup, because you were under our umbrella for a very long time. And we sent you off with our blessing about 1980, 1981. And you know, the reason, Chiltern and Thames went and they formed their intergroup, and then we had Thames Valley, and then there was us. But we supported Reading for a very long time. I mean, a lot of my memories are coming to a meeting somewhere in the Oxford Road. I think it was a step meeting, and speaking there. And always with a car full and whatnot. But you know, it was wonderful to be in at a time when all this was developing. We didn't have, you know, we were called the assembly. There was intergroup, the assembly, and then there was conference and whatnot. And there were all the different stages. And I remember sitting in the room in Swindon, being told I was to go there, that I was the regional rep. But we hadn't become regionalised at the time, so I probably wasn't called a regional rep. And I went, and John L. was sitting beside me, and I said, John, I don't know why I'm here. I don't know anything about this. I don't know what really is going on. He said, relax, he said, you'll learn. And that's really how I learned all along, but it was the help of those older men. Now, I must tell you about Bampton on a Wednesday night. Bampton was held in a man's beautiful house, a very beautiful manor house, and we were in the dining room around the beautiful table, and we all behaved impeccably. It's amazing what a building can do for you, really. We all behaved very well, and Bill of Bampton, whose daughter is a very good friend of mine, Bill was in AA. He was responsible, really, for one of the ones that got AA going in Oxford back in the mid-60s. Now, AA had come to Oxford 60 years ago last April, but we can't trace back what happened between then and the mid-60s, and we have all the history of it from the mid-60s onwards. And we have made a CD of the history of our intergroup to celebrate the 60 years. But I would go to Bampton on a Wednesday evening, and I'd pick Scottish Ian up on the way. And one Wednesday night, he said, "There's a present for you." And I looked, and it was the 24-hour book. I thought, I've read that over and over again, because Barry had literature and had everything all over the house. But his little black book sat on the back of the toilet. So all my children knew what the little black book was, and they all read the little black book while they were in the bathroom. And I was so angry. What's he giving me that for? Anyway, for a long time, I wouldn't read at all. I'd read the thought for today, for the day at the bottom. But in Bampton, at 9:03, there'd be a knock on the door, and it would be the butler telling Bill that our coffee was ready, and we'd get hot sausage rolls with the coffee. And we were, you know, it was lovely. A lady in that time used to be chauffeur-driven up from Bath to the meeting, and I said to her, I had the courage to say to her one Wednesday night, "Why don't you go to the meetings in Bath? Why do you come all this way?" "I have my anonymity to be think of." She was Swiss. And there's so many, but my gosh, have I gained from it. Some of you know that a son of ours was killed in the mid-80s, and thank God I was 11 years sober. And thank God Sue was there on that day too. And she was wonderful to me on that day. We were at a convention in Bristol, and the theme was, can you bear it, beyond my wildest dreams. And I thought, I don't ever want to know that theme again, because David being killed at the age of 23 was far beyond our wildest dreams. And AA just wrapped itself around me. Just absolutely wrapped itself around me. And I'm not the easiest one to be wrapped around, because I tend to, you know, leave me alone, I'll be all right. And I still have a trace of that in me. Whether I'll ever lose it or not, I don't know. But maybe at times it's not a bad thing, I don't know. And they were just so lovely to me. And I think then, even though I was all those years in, I think it was only then that I understood the depth, the sheer depth of love and warmth that AA, your fellow people in AA are capable of giving you. And then you do recover, but you don't stop grieving. But it doesn't, you know, you have to come to terms with life, and I'm explaining it very badly. But David was a very colourful young man, probably too colourful for his own good. He was killed in Spain, and we had 3 weeks of waiting for his body to be brought back. And I can tell you that was something that was horrendous. And it was the Irish Minister for Foreign Affairs eventually managed to get him back for us. I wonder if we would ever have got him back if we hadn't known somebody in some places. Anyway, and then I go on, and you know, life, I'm old, I expect I'm the oldest person in the room. I'm getting old. And you know, life continues to challenge me. I had reason the other day to think, the older I am, number one, the less I know, but number two is human beings baffle me completely. My house was on the market for a while, and I thought it was sold last February, and we were to exchange some weeks ago, and they pulled out the day before we exchanged. And I had emptied my house of all my life, really, and just left with. But in a way, there's something quite nice about having a house that's sort of empty. There's somebody else, I think, maybe going to buy it now, but, you know, I've got to the stage that I think maybe I'm meant to. That step 11 has been my guide. Where would I be without step 3 and step 11? And somewhere or other, I'm beginning to wonder if I'm not meant to stay where I am. And it's going to fall down around me, but does it really matter as long as if the rain doesn't actually come down on me? And things like that, you know, life is full of challenges. Unfortunately, our bodies get old. I don't think my spirit does, and I hope it never does. And certainly I hope, oh, I pray and I hope I'll never lose my sense of humor. I'm so often asked, why do you still go to meetings? And it's because I came home from Narm Gardens one night when I was going there in my early days of going to Narm Gardens, and I was in a filthy temper. And that's not really the way to come from a meeting, is it? Filthy temper. And Barry, he could sense it before I came into the room. The telegraph went up. How was your meeting? I said, awful. They did this, they did that, and they didn't do that, and they didn't do this, and da 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 da. And I was going up, flouncing up the stairs, and a voice said, I wonder, would you be part of the problem yourself? Well, when I didn't come back and do that too. Anyway, I went up and I slung my clothes off me all around the room. I'm never going to AA again. I'm fed up with the whole damn thing. My father, who had a drink problem, he stopped drinking when I was in my teens. Right, he never drank again. Barry would drive you mad with recovery because he's playing rugby, not playing rugby, going to rugby, going to the races, doing prison work, doing everything. And I suddenly came to my senses and I thought, which would you choose? Which would you choose? I hadn't a choice. My father was a lovely, quiet gentleman with the most beautiful expressive eyes. And he never had AA. And he was this lonely, lovely figure in the armchair in the corner of our sitting room by the fire. And you could almost touch the isolation. Now you're very like him, so you can have that, or you can have a full life. So I got down on my knees that night and I made a commitment to myself, to AA. And I thought, I came into this fellowship and it was in a very healthy state. Those men in Aylesbury, wonderful gentlemen, they made you feel safe, they looked after you, they made sure that things were run properly in the intergroup. And you have a responsibility now to do ditto for those coming behind. So as long as I can keep walking and talking, I hope to continue to come. One of my prayers is, please God, keep it fresh for me, keep it green for me. Because at 40 years, you know, you think, I've heard it all. They're all making the same mistakes again. Intergroup has not been run the way it should be run. So just go to your meetings, do what you can, but particularly look out for the lonely one, the new one, the sick one, the one that might be in quite a while and be sober a while, but because they're sober a while, they can be going through hell. But nobody, or not many, will stop to say, but how are you really? And that gets me. And those of you that know me, or knew me, you haven't seen me for a long time, know that Barry dropped dead on the golf course 8 years ago. And that was beyond words, really. That was a shocking shock. So therefore, another big challenge, please AA, do your work. And I got to my meetings and did what I was supposed to do. And remember waking up one morning after I had told my family, you don't have to stay, just go to your homes. I've got to face this, I have to do this. and thinking, this is another phase. And it dawned on me, I've had a lot of different lives, if you like, you know, all these different kind of, and each section of my life has challenged me. And I think perhaps I'm better when I'm up against it than when, I'd like it to, a while of things going like that, but at the moment they're going a bit like that. My youngest son is, as I said, I took him to a meeting some time ago, he's in early recovery, and he's going to Wantage on a Tuesday night, and at first I thought, I can't stand this, that's not your territory. Wantage was Barry's, but anyway, it's lovely, and I hope Barry is, you know, looks down on him and gives him the strength to come through, because I hadn't any communication from him for over 2 years. And I have found it, and he was in recovery in Ireland last year, and I have found it very hard to come to terms with that. It's very hard being the parent of a drinking alcoholic. And I'm sure some of you have the same experience. How much do you help? How much do you not help? But anyway, I have said my say to him. And he was living with me this year for 5 months. And even if he was never an alcoholic, that's not easy on the younger person, and it's not easy on the older person. But he's now in a place of his own. And, you know, it's continually... On this program, you're asked to let go, to let go, to let go. Some mornings I'm on my knees and I think, I haven't any more to give. My energy is all dried up. I really don't have any more to give. And then I have to give myself a good talking to and say, for today you have enough energy, so get on with it. And thank you all for listening, and I hope some of it made some sense.
Thank you. Thank you.